Today's program was brought to you by craftbeer.com, dedicated to small and independent U.S. craft brewers. For more information, visit craftbeer.com.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. We're a member-supported food radio network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. Join our hosts as they lead you through the world of craft brewing, behind the scenes of the restaurant industry, inside the battle over school food, and beyond. Find us at heritageradionetwork.org.
Welcome to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, a cooking store located at 100 Frost Street in Williamsburg, Brooklyn. Join me every Wednesday as I talk with people about what they do and how it influences their personal food stories. This is a show about people, life, and food. And today, a little bit more about drink, actually. Today's episode number 66 of Feast Your Ears, and I'm pleased to have in the studio with me Dave Carreco of Arcane Distilling, who is producing a Fernet and whiskey using what I think most people would call a slightly unorthodox process. Seems actually more like the logical next steps in technological advancement in spirits production,
I'll
potentially, and is sort of related to almost like perfume
sure.
production, and we'll talk a little bit about that. When we first met, actually, he had developed a system for fermentation, both fermentation and distillation, that was focused on vodka that he built himself, which I found really impressive and was unlike anything I'd ever seen in a commercial beverage production facility. So thanks so much for joining me today on Feast Your Ears.
No problem.
So I want to start, people like to start at the beginning. So I want to know, like, what was your first... What was your first introduction into fermentation and beverage production?
Oh, okay. my first introduction to fermentation was actually for fish tanks.
Oh.
So I was making CO2 to inject into these fish tanks. The idea was to really keep the efficiency as great as possible on these underwater ecosystems. So you have to feed them light, you have to feed them oxygen, and you have to feed them carbon. So you'd feed them carbon in the form of carbon dioxide.
And you were growing plants underwater for the fish?
Yeah, I was growing plants underwater, tiny little fish, tiny little shrimp. The idea was to have as low input as possible.
Hmm. And was the idea for a food source or just for pleasure to look at them? What was the goal?
So originally it was just a concept of, hey, wouldn't it be neat if? And then the more I messed with it... I realized it was really beautiful, and I'm pretty opposed to most forms of marine aquaculture, not for food, but for in terms of like fish tank husbandry or fish keeping.
Sure.
A lot of it's poached, and it's basically keeping these fish on life support.
Yeah.
So I got focused on, well, what if I could sort of disrupt this business of going out and poaching these reef fish by making something that was even more beautiful, that would essentially take care of itself.
Hmm.
You know, you have happy fish when they're just breeding in the tank and,
right.
You know, everybody's enjoying themselves.
You mention it being beautiful. Is that something you strive for in when you build the equipment that you're using? Because I will say the fermentation tanks that you had designed that were really columns.
Yeah.
I thought they were beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, there's an aesthetic that I definitely strive for. I have a background in art, and I'm not going to say that that's why I strive for it, but something that I learned was that often in the art world, if you make something that's functional and beautiful, it's seen as lower.
Hmm.
I think that's horseshit, and
right.
I think that a certain amount of aesthetic in a functional object only adds to its function. You want to use it. It works for you and for what it does.
Yeah.
I used to write code, and I was very proud if my code was beautiful inside as well as being able to make the front end of it was, you know, did its job, was beautiful as well.
So what was your next step after fish? So you were fermenting to create CO2
yeah,
for
yeah.
fish.
I'd done a little beer, you know, like you do. But the problem when I was doing the fish tank concept is that I had a waste product, and that was alcohol. So that's what got me into distillation.
Right, and when you're making beer, you don't think of the alcohol as the waste product.
No.
That's actually the
product. The goal. Yes. Yeah. So that's the whole progression in a nutshell.
And then from there, you move to creating a fermentation system.
Sure.
To create a mash that
right.
could then be distilled
yeah.
in a fairly traditional way, even though you built the equipment yourself, right?
It was
through heat and condensing. The
right. alcohol. It was done at atmospheric pressure,
right.
which is the key here. The physics of ethanol and water are determined by their pressure. That determines when they boil, you know,
right.
their bubble point. And that determines how they interact with each other, because at some point you actually can't distill them apart any further. But under vacuum, you can.
Aha. Uh-huh. And so vacuum distilling
yes.
is what you're using now for your Arcane Fernet
yes.
and your Lone Wolf Whiskey.
Yeah.
So explain both to me and the listeners what makes, you know, for as a basic explanation of distillation, the way, say, when you buy Jameson's,
sure,
you know, that is they make a mash
sure.
that has a certain percentage of alcohol
mm-hmm.
that's not spirit level yet,
right.
probably 20% or
right.
so. They put that through a still between 1 and 5 times, probably depending on who the distillery
sure.
is. And that is a still is a, for those of you who don't know, it's a big pot basically that heats it, and the alcohol boils off first before the water. It goes into,
well, actually, yeah, I mean, yes, but in conjunction with the water as well.
I see.
Yeah. So that's another thing that, I would say that the most important thing to take away from distillation process is that you've reduced something that has many, many, many different types of components, both volatile and not. So water and alcohol are volatile components. They can be evaporated. Like you can
right.
you can remove all of the water and all the alcohol and wind up with a distillate that's, you know, only 5% alcohol, because your starting beer was 5% alcohol.
Right.
What's left over are all your proteins, all your residual sugars, any biomass that was formed, like yeast, salts. And it's you know, the reason why seeing gluten-free on alcohol makes me so fucking angry. but, you know, moving right along.
Sure. So in the traditional sense, that, you know, that Jameson's on the shelf or whatever you whatever you normally drink, unless you're a normal consumer of Arcane Fernet or Lone Wolf whiskey, is the alcohol is concentrated through heating,
yeah,
and then condensing
mm-hmm.
what boils off basically.
Sure.
So tell me how vacuum distillation is different.
Well, vacuum distillation differs very simply in that by reducing the ambient pressure below atmospheric norm, you're able to dramatically lower the temperature at which a liquid will evaporate.
Hmm.
So for instance, at atmosphere, you know, like sea level, since we're in
yep.
you know, Brooklyn, you're like 14% alcohol mash is going to boil off at around 85 degrees Celsius, 87 degrees Celsius, something like that. And under vacuum, really depends on how strong a vacuum I want to pull. But I can get that. Actually, you know what? A better example would be just used water.
Because sure.
that's a simpler thing.
Sure, and everybody knows from
yeah.
high school physics that water boils at 100 degrees Celsius.
Right, or 212 if you yeah. are Fahrenheit-driven, which
let's
I am
let's
not.
Try not to be.
Okay, great. I approve of that. So, yeah, at ambient, so standard temperature and pressure, which is, you know, where we are almost right now. It's kind of nice temperature in this place. If you were to put heat into a cup of water, it will start to boil at 100 Celsius. But as soon as you reduce that pressure, like say I reduce it by half, and there's an old school measure that I like to use when talking about it because you can see it visually. Because if I start talking about bars, this is
right
now we're, you know, and then I go into millibars and torr and stuff like that.
Bar is a measurement of pressure.
Right.
For the,
you know, yeah. And it's like, what the fuck is that?
Right.
So there's this old school measure of pressure called inches of mercury vacuum.
Mm.
And that's would be as if I had a pan of mercury and I put a glass tube suspended into just touching that pan. And then I put a hose on the top of that tube. And if I applied a vacuum and sucked out the air.
So it's based on the weight of the mercury.
Right, so it would suck the mercury up the tube. So you can think of ambient pressure, so no vacuum, ambient pressure, as being 0 inches of mercury vacuum. And then if you want to think of full vacuum, that's about 29.5 inches of mercury vacuum. And that's intense. That'll take most vessels and crunch them like a beer can.
Now, I don't suggest that anybody put a straw into a vessel full of mercury and try and suck on it. Could be pretty bad for you. When I was a kid, I had a friend whose father was a scientist, and we used to play around in his sort of home workshop.
Oh.
And I remember very specifically being a 16-ounce glass bottle full of mercury that we were all like, oh my God, it's so heavy. And we poured it in our hands, and we played with it.
I've done that too.
Around the table. You know, only to discover later that that's where, you know, the idea of the Mad Hatter comes from, is from mercury getting into the body.
Well, that's a very specific type of mercury. Actually, pure mercury, elemental mercury, isn't that toxic.
Oh, interesting.
It's not toxic.
Yeah, sure.
But it's not like methyl mercury. That's very bioassimilable. That'll fuck you up good.
Got it.
But like, anyway, we're
so what you're telling me is that using my playing with mercury as an excuse for missing brain cells is actually probably
that's
correct.
Alcohol.
Okay.
Yeah.
and probably other things as well. So back to distillation.
So if you can think of 0 inches of mercury as boiling at 100 Celsius, you can think of as 28 inches of mercury as boiling at like 30 Celsius.
Wow.
A little less. And that's what I'm doing. I'm using this vacuum to intensely lower the energy input requirement. So you don't even have to think about it as heat anymore.
Yep.
But the energy input into the system to get it to boil is dramatically reduced. And that has a number of benefits.
Yeah, I was going to throw you a softball and just say, why?
Yeah, why?
why do this? If everybody else is doing this other process, why are you doing it this way?
The thing is, I'm not the only one doing it. I'm the only one doing it possibly on this scale and with this product. Hmm. Because it's a giant pain in the ass to develop the equipment and get it running right. There's a certain amount of process error and tuning with a vacuum system, because it's your vacuum determines everything else. You can't just go, oh, it's that temperature, I've got that alcohol coming off. It's like, no, you better go check your vacuum, and then you better go consult your tables.
It's all a ratio. Yeah.
And it's like you got to look at your vapor speeds, and it can be really hairy. But one of the major advantages to vacuum distillation is the preservation of delicate materials. And it's the reason why it's used primarily in things like perfume and in medicine. You'll use something like a rotary evaporator to remove a solvent from a bunch of amino acids, because you don't want to denature those proteins. And if you apply that to things like scents and smells, that's exactly what they are. They're not some magic, you know, there's no like little magic little oranges floating around and in the air. It's all this plethora of chemistry.
Yeah.
So if you take a page out of medicine and into science, you find that I'm not going to say that distillation is simple. It is most definitely not. But it's very well studied. It's very well studied because the scientists and chemical producers of the world, they just don't want to lose their jobs.
Well, you know, it's big business.
Yeah. I mean, oh, no, it's absolutely.
Alcohol is big business.
I'm not even talking about alcohol. I mean, the most common industrial solvent is water.
Yep.
And you need to be able to evaporate that out to concentrate materials. And there are dozens of different ways to do that. I am just doing one of them. But by applying that to things that would often lose their character, lose their flavor if you heated them. Actually, you know, I know you cook.
Right.
I know that you love to cook, and there's a time and a place to use certain herbs. Some of your herbs are used while you're cooking, and you want them to stew down and impart some sort of flavors. But then you have your finishing herbs, and you wouldn't dream of ever, like, throwing them in the beginning and stewing them down. It's like, stewed down sage. Yummy. You know?
I mean, I also, you know, I think that there's an interesting reference point from homebrewing there with the use of hops.
Mm-hmm.
And what I think of in my experience homebrewing is that, you know, when you put the hops into the wort, has such an effect on what the final notes or final tastes or smells and what you get out of those hops.
Yeah, and you can tune it.
Exactly.
That's great. Yeah. And it's exactly what I'm trying to do is trying to emphasize that if you start with something that's already delicious, like beer, and you turn it into a whiskey using a traditional process, you've basically just destroyed it.
Right, because you cook it.
You cooked it. And now you've turned it into just another wort, another whiskey mash, which is a shame because it had such amazing character that you will not find in a whiskey mash. So don't do that.
So then tell me about Lone Wolf. So how do you create Lone Wolf? And what do you – so Lone Wolf is a distilled whiskey.
Yes.
Made from an already finished beer.
Yes.
And you are collaborating with breweries.
Yeah, and home brewers as well.
Cool. And so are you looking for certain things in that starting beer, or is the only thing that's really important that it be delicious and that it will yield a delicious whiskey when
you
distill it?
That's it. I've distilled a lot of beers at this point, about 50, and, I've distilled everything from, you know, triple IPAs to, sour beers like Flemish Reds. I've done Saisons, I've done all Brett beers, I've done Imperial Pilsners, I've done a lager, I've all these different things. I've distilled perfect beer, I've distilled fucked up beer to see, you know, can it be
sure.
And what's great is that in the world of beer, what I love about it so much is that people have all of these different options. It's like, if you want to make a big IPA, well, now you've got like 100 different hops to choose from. Cool. Now you get your hops. You've got your malt bill to talk about. And then ultimately you have your yeast to talk about. And all these things contribute minute or major flavors right. to this final product. And I wanted to capture exactly that as a snapshot. And turn that into a whiskey. I don't want to break it back down to its malt bill and have some sort of like vegetal residue of something reminiscent of hop.
Right.
I wanted exactly the hops. Yeah.
Great. We're going to take a short break and hear from one of our sponsors. While we're taking a break, we're going to pour some whiskey. And when we come back, we'll talk about it.
Love craft beer? The diversity of styles and flavors? The stories of small brewery businesses and the communities behind today's craft beer movement? If so, you'll love craftbeer.com, published by the Brewers Association. Whether you tasted your first craft beer 30 years ago or just caught the bug last week, craftbeer.com is the number one destination for beer education, news, and recipes. Looking for a local brewery? Use the internet's most robust brewery finder to discover your new favorite place. Want to get geeky about your favorite beer style or find the perfect pairing for dinner? CraftBeer.com is the leading authority and can help. Celebrate the best of American beer. Visit CraftBeer.com today.
Welcome back to Feast Your Ears. I'm Harry Rosenblum from the Brooklyn Kitchen, and today David Carreco is joining me and is in the studio here at Roberta's at Heritage Radio. Before the break, we were sort of discussing Dave's journey into fermentation and distillation and talking about why he has chosen to use vacuum distilling. And so during the break there, he poured me a glass of his Lone Wolf whiskey. made from, distilled from Other Half Brewing's Short, Dark, and Wired, which was a coffee stout. And I have yet to taste it, but I'm excited to. Tastes like whiskey.
Mm-hmm.
But you definitely can taste the stout and the cacao and the aspects of it, which is amazing because, as you pointed out before the break, if you were to heat that beer up and you were to boil it, essentially, all of those flavors would essentially disappear.
Or at least they'd be reduced, and then they'd also make new flavors that you don't necessarily want, that the only way to get rid of them would be to put them into a barrel for, you know, 4, 5, 6, 7 years.
Yeah, and this doesn't have the... So from a, like, process standpoint, you might, you know, one might think tasting this, oh, this is like a white whiskey, right? It's unaged, it didn't spend 12 years in a warehouse in Kentucky.
Right.
But it doesn't taste that
No,
way.
It does
doesn't
not.
Taste the, I mean, I find the white whiskey thing, as someone who, you know, got very into bourbon, I don't know, about 20 years ago before it was really, like, super popular and there were 1,000 different versions on the market. When all the new sort of younger distilleries started doing white whiskey, I was like, that's a joke. It's just so you can sell your product faster, and it's not very good.
I mean, it wasn't designed to be good, I don't think.
No, of course not.
I think it was aged. Yeah. So one of the side effects I found when doing the vacuum distilled process was that a lot of the compounds didn't break down. They didn't turn into other things. So it's when you take something that's got all these different chemistries in it and also a lot of organic matter, like beer, and you heat it up, what's going to happen is that it's going to spontaneously start to break down and recombine with other things, especially if you have any, like, volatile acidity. That's going to pair up with your alcohols and you're going to get all these esters, but not in a good way. And that's why you need to put your whiskey into a barrel, and you have to put it there for 4 to 5 years. You can't just use a smaller barrel. It just doesn't work that way.
Because it's not just about the
extraction.
It's not just about the extraction. Yeah. It's about the time.
It's about the chemical reactions.
Right.
And it's like, if you know anything about you know, even the most basic chemistry, there's only two things that work in that case. Well, three things, if you want to be really accurate. Either you add a catalyst, which is why I was, you know, had to change it to three things, or you have more heat, or you have more time.
Right.
That's what you do. Adding heat gives you all kinds of problems. Adding a catalyst could be pretty nasty. So you're going to want to use some time there.
Right.
A little time there, bud. So what's cool about the beer whiskeys is that none of these byproducts are created. Whatever went into the beer is what comes out as the whiskey. Because it's happening at such a low temperature, none of these side reactions are occurring. This is most noticeable in the sour beers, which sour beers are kind of impossible to distill.
I was going to say, let's talk about that.
Yeah,
because
yeah.
Sour beers are sour because they have acids in them.
Shit ton of acid,
and
yeah.
And they have, you know, there's other things. There's Brettanomyces and there's lactobacillus in there. And so you have lactic acid and you have other acids. So how does that affect the distillation?
Yeah, so let's talk about lactic acid, since that's a pretty common, delicious acid. I mean, acetic acid is nice in small amounts, like in your Flemish reds and stuff like that.
I mean, as a vinegar maker, I think that acetic acid
is
super delicious, but I hear you.
But
from,
like,
a stylistic point of beer,
and beer,
what you want.
I mean, I love me some Flemish and some Flanders, but, you know, that doesn't... I mean, I have distilled them, but just not in general. So when you have lactic acid in the presence of alcohol and temperature, what you're going to get is ethyl lactate. And ethyl lactate in very small amounts is tasty. So it's got like a sweet flavor, a little pear-like. But if you've got a decent amount of acid, you all of a sudden now have a shit ton of this ester, which is like nail polish remover. Acetone.
And what are we talking about? When I mean, you know, obviously everything we're talking about here is ratios. So when you say a little bit is delicious, what are we talking about?
We're talking about parts per billion.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then having too much that's going to taste like nail polish remover.
It's like, oh, this is really hot whiskey, which is the reason why I don't like that terminology. It's like, well, okay, what solvent are you talking about, sir?
Sure.
You know, but that's what's going to contribute to it. That's why you need that time in that barrel is to take that ester and actually have it react with the wood, get some wood esterification going on.
It's interesting. That makes perfect sense. And as someone who is a vinegar maker from the kind of food and experimentation side, not the scientific mm-hmm. side, one of the things that happens with vinegar making is that sometimes you do get the acetone and you do get that nail polish remover smell. And the thing that you can solve that is by time in a barrel.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I didn't.
It's uptake. Yeah. It's also off-gassing.
Yep.
So it's just like that angel share. There's all kinds of these like insane products for craft whiskey now. It's like there's barrel sealers where they like coat their barrels and to hold that angel share. And, you know, it's touted as, you know, you can save 15%.
Right.
It's like, that's not, what are you doing?
It's actually what you don't want.
You don't want that. I don't want to drink that.
Right.
That's, okay. So yeah, the beauty of here is that, I mean, as you notice, it's like, this is not really an aged whiskey.
No.
And it's like, well, wait, but why? So the next one's really going to, explain more about the herb thing that I was talking about.
And I'm guessing based on how you're making these, that these are fairly limited production. Right.
Oh yeah, extremely. Right now, with the equipment that I have, I'm making 7 to 10 bottles a week.
Oh wow! And where are the, who's lucky enough to get their hands on them?
Really, it's just the people that follow on the Instagram.
Got it.
I also have a sign up sheet on my website for people that actually want to make their own. They can contact me and propose. You know, hey, I want to make this beer and turn it into a whiskey, and if I like it, and I'll give you the green light.
Oh, that's great. So then they can come to you.
Yeah, you can find it on my website.
Awesome.
It says, I want to brew for Lone Wolf.
Great. So so people who are interested in that, you should look at arcanedistilling.com and you should follow on Instagram at @arcane_NYC to find out more about it, because that is an incredibly limited production. I mean,
yeah.
I know, you know, here in Brooklyn, we're all about like artisanal, like small batch, but that's really low production.
Yeah, this is annoying level
great,
small batch.
But it's a great product. I mean, I feel like it's important to ask. I mean, I'm guessing that you, now that you have proof of theory and that this thing works, you are working on scaling it up.
Yeah. Like I said, I haven't talked too much about the equipment, but it's not your normal equipment. And there are some people that use vacuum assisted distillation in spirits. I'm not the only one doing it, but this level of vacuum that I'm talking about would take most of, even your vacuum stills that are designed for like gin use, it would crush them like a beer can.
Right.
So this is all industrial and medical level design, which it doesn't come cheap.
Right.
It took me about 13 months to scrounge together the parts for my current machines. Some of them I had fabricated,
It's not like you can just call a company and buy one off the shelf.
You can. Absolutely. Yeah. You just better have, $90,000 to $150,000 lying around for a small one.
Got it.
Like for the one my size, it'd be about $70,000 to $80,000.
Right. Got it.
So
well, so let's talk about this next whiskey, which I mean I just gave a smell.
Oh yeah, it just fills up the place.
It does. I mean it smells like we're suddenly sitting in a room full of hops.
Yeah. So this is KCBC's Dangerous Precedent.
Wow.
So Kings County Brewing Collective, they're over in Bushwick as well. So their Dangerous Precedent was their first double IPA, and they gave me a keg. And this awesome liquid came out.
Man, it is awesome,
right?
I mean, it's amazing. the smell is like a super fruity IPA, you get an incredible amount of like citrus notes in the taste. The whiskey itself is not super hot as we describe it, and it almost has a spicy finish.
Yeah,
which is not the same as sort of the hot flavor you get from like an overproof whiskey. It's spicy.
These are the flavors of your hops. You're getting the resins and the oils from the hops for real. So there's a reason why that all of my whiskey comes in a brown bottle. It's skunks,
right?
The hop oils are there in small amounts, but they're there, and it's not vile to drink if it gets a little light strike, but it's different. It tastes like I've had some other hopped whiskeys before, and I was like, oh, yeah, Corona. Nice.
Yeah.
And it's just, it always kind of drives me crazy. It's like you went out of your way. So another thing to mention is that this is possibly the most expensive whiskey to make by mash bill in the world.
I was going to ask because, I mean, what we're talking about is like craft beer that's already expensive and hard to get and produced in very limited amounts.
Yep.
And then when you say a keg, was it a six-stall or was it a half barrel? So we're talking about 5 gallons.
We're talking about $160 six-stall making 7 bottles.
Right.
So that's the starting point.
Right. And so then if you're going to have that be an actual production that then you're going to sell, not only is there the value in the product, the time, the very specific process, then there's the fact that it is so limited.
Yeah. I mean, luckily, a lot of the breweries are friends of mine, and they've been really awesome about supporting the project. And either I'll just be, you know, given a six-stall. And then, you know, they have to taste, they have to make sure that the whiskey's good in return.
Oh,
you know,
of course,
there's a testing process.
Well, their name's going to be on it. So, you know, I understand that.
But if it wasn't for that, it's, like you'll see these craft whiskeys being sold for, you know, $75 a bottle. And you're just like, oh, that's neat and all. Yeah. The starting price for Lone Wolf before I've even touched it is like $16 a bottle.
Right. Just for the liquid.
And that's wholesale.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
And that's not even, doesn't count the bottle, the label, the distribution, marketing, any of the other costs that go into it. And that's for a $375.
That's for a $375.
Not for a $750.
Yeah, so. Yeah. So it's like, yeah, I can break down the cost for you if you want.
Well, it is, I mean, I will say it is spectacular. As someone who I would say I tasted a lot of whiskeys. I'm not a whiskey expert. I don't go in for like the, you know. I'm lucky enough that my brother lives in Kentucky and has managed to score some bottles of the very like super rare, you know, George T. Stagg bourbons and stuff at retail instead of the like crazy retail.
Retail,
you know, retail in Kentucky for those is like $65 a bottle, which is great. They're delicious. Not the like $500 or $600 a bottle that they fetch when they get
the trading prices.
Yeah.
I mean, something I should mention is that I'm not against traditional processed whiskey at all.
Right.
I'm against fucking it up.
Yep.
It's, you know, don't be making a bourbon that's 9 months old and calling it a bourbon. Just call it something else.
Yeah.
Like when people ask me what Lone Wolf is, I tell them it's beer whiskey. They're like, well, that's not a classification. It's like, you're right. It's malt whiskey. But to be more accurate, it's beer whiskey.
Sure. Because if you told me this was malt whiskey, this tastes like beer.
Right. Yeah, this tastes like 7 IPAs at once. Like, what's
going earlier
on?
You mentioned something about gluten free, right? So this came from beer, which came from malted barley.
Yeah.
Which people who are gluten free say they can't drink. Can they drink this?
So you can drink any distilled spirits ever. I don't care if it came from like pure gluten and you somehow like sicked a bunch of
distilled a pizza.
I don't care. It doesn't matter. Gluten, it goes back to what I said in the beginning. It was like you have your volatile components and your non-volatile components. Gluten isn't, you're not volatile. I can't evaporate you, Harry, and you like float up into the air.
Although I bet you could find people who would totally pay to be vacuum distilled.
Desiccated. Vacuum desiccated. So that actually, there you go. So you could be vacuum desiccated.
Right. It's like being cryogenically frozen, but it's like a different version.
No, it's not. In this case, we're sucking out all of your moisture by making everything about you that's volatile evaporate.
Got it.
So yeah, for all you people that are actually like celiac sufferers, feel free to drink whatever the fuck you want. But I do say that if you find that a bottle says gluten free, don't buy it because you know the people that sell it are assholes.
Yeah, they're just trying to trade on something that
on
should
fear.
Already be true.
Yeah, right? It's messed up. It's something that I try to actively talk about because
I'm totally with you. I mean, when I see products that wouldn't normally have gluten anyway, like yogurt that says gluten free, I'm just like, well, of course the yogurt's gluten free.
Yeah,
why would it have gluten in it anyway?
Yeah. One place that I found that I actually understand it is people that are making canned cider or bottled cider because people think that it's made with beer and apples.
Sure.
Because I don't know why people get confused, but they do.
Because they're trained to think that a 12-ounce long neck
is a beer. And I kind of get that. I kind of get why you have to talk about it. Yep. I do. But no, if you have it on a spirits bottle, nah.
Well, I'd love to. We have another bottle sitting here, which is your Fernet.
Uh-huh.
So I want to understand, you know, Fernet is something that I feel like I do think, whether true or not, for me personally, we are sitting at Roberta's. Roberta's is, I think, responsible to some extent for the popularity of Fernet in the last 10 years. It was actually the owners of Roberta's with whom I first tasted Fernet, actually at a bachelor party. We'd gone out and we ate some really, really crappy Chinese food in
That'll
Staten Island. And then one of them, we were in a van, and one of them said, "Oh, we got to go to a liquor store and get some Fernet." And I was like, "Fernet? What's that?" I'd never gotten into Amaro, so Fernet wasn't on my radar.
Yeah.
But since then, and Fernet certainly has like taken over. It's like the bartender's drink, right?
Yeah, I would say that you've hit every single point of what makes Fernet what it is, especially New York City.
Except that I haven't talked about any of the flavors or any of what's really in
it.
I've only talked about the brand.
Yeah, I'd say that's not that important in some ways. It's
Fernet Branca, that is.
Fernet Branca, yeah. Most people, so people are a little confused about that. Fernet is not Fernet Branca. Fernet Branca, it's like squares and rectangles.
Yep.
So Fernet Branca is a type of Amaro. Not all Amaro is Fernet Branca.
Right.
Fernet Branca is a brand of Fernet. Not all Fernet is Fernet Branca.
Right.
So
Arcane, so you make a Fernet.
Right.
Which is a type of Amaro.
Right. A bitter Amaro. Right.
A bitter Amaro.
Bitter Amaro. And the reason why this came about, it started as a dare. This guy I know basically bet me. Just trying to push my buttons because I build distillation equipment. And he's like, "Well, yeah, you can do this, but can you make something like Fernet?" Just like that. I was like,
"Sure,
I'll take that bet."
And I can see where he was coming from, right? I mean, the bartenders love it, and they, you know, it's meant to be both a digestive.
Mm-hmm.
They use it in cocktails, and it's a secret. It's a famous.
And you know how I feel about that?
Yeah. Famously secret recipe for what's in it.
So I luckily I had some help. I was able to, you know, basically go to all my friends, bartenders, bar owners that drink Fernet, and I was like, "All right, I'm gonna make this Fernet that tastes like Branca, but I don't really like Branca. Name me one thing about Branca you don't like." And I basically compiled this list of things. I won the bet because I made one that tasted like Branca.
Right.
You can still tell that it wasn't like perfectly spot on, but it was enough that it was like, okay, you got it. You checked all the boxes. But I realized after doing all that work, it's like I really should just take it all the way.
Right.
I compiled this list of things that people would change about Branca. And they had some really good suggestions.
So, yours is much less astringent.
Yeah, yeah.
Branca is very astringent. It's actually the thing I don't like about it.
So that was the number one thing, was Branca face or Fernet face.
Mm-hmm.
It was like you'd take a sip and everybody would sort of wince.
Yeah, at the end, it's like it's sucking out the inside of your throat.
Astringent, yeah. And it would stick with you, too. It wouldn't go away.
Yeah.
And that was the other thing, is that it was too sweet.
Yep.
So it was this combination of, it's dry and parchingly astringent, which makes you wince, but then you can't get it out of your mouth because the sugar kind of like seals it in.
Yep.
And I was like, all right, I can nix those things. That's cool.
Yeah.
The other thing was that it didn't finish cleanly.
Mm.
So I was like, cool, I'll work on that. But the thing that everybody agreed on was that it should soothe your stomach.
Yep.
So I spent a lot of time figuring out, okay, what... I just want to focus on that because I like that a lot. So I kept in some of the traditional herbs like gentian root. But then I turned to, in some ways, my experience with the Lone Wolf Project, which is hops. And I was like, oh, yeah, how about we use some bittering, digestive, promoting flowers? Let's do that. So there's two to three different types of hops in every batch. It rotates slightly depending on the hops that I get. Hops are a seasonal crop and they change. And actually they have a little change depending on where the location that you got them from.
Right.
And they're a large part of the Fernet itself. So it's important. But 27 recipes later,
this is it.
Arcane Fernet.
It's delicious.
Yeah.
So does this have a larger production than Lone Wolf? Is this something people might actually be able to buy?
Yeah. So this has been getting very popular in Brooklyn with originally the people that I'd ask, how am I doing, guys?
Right.
Oh, I'll give you some notes, Dave. Here you go. And it's really starting to branch out. So I'm making about 35 cases of this, 12 bottle cases of this a month right now.
Oh, good.
And yeah, you can just go on the website and there's a store finder. Be like, yeah, I'm looking for bottles of Arcane Fernet. I think actually Roberto's carries it by the shot.
Cool.
But yeah, you can buy bottles of it. You can get shots of it. And there's some bars like Cardiff Giant, like which is up on Myrtle.
Yep.
That specializes only in New York State products. They were like drumming on the table waiting for this because it's the only New York State.
Right.
Fernet. So they're just like, yes!
Finally, they can serve a Fernet, yeah.
Yeah, so it's this isn't just like another Brooklyn product. It's actually made here.
Yep.
So
awesome. Well, we unfortunately are pretty much out of time, but we could go on for hours. Perhaps I'll have to have you on for a follow-up episode of Feast Your Ears. But definitely everybody should check out arcanedistilling.com and at @arcane_NYC to follow Dave and his adventures in Lone Wolf Whiskey and Arcane Fernet. It's awesome. I'm gonna check as soon as we're done here to see if Vine Wine is carrying it. And if
I think they do.
Not, I hope they are because I live upstairs. Ah. It'll be very easy for me to pick up a bottle on my way home. If not, I'm going to make sure that they do start carrying it so I can pick up a bottle on my way home. Any other upcoming projects, events, places you'll be serving or where people can find your stuff that you want to mention?
I mean, the best way is to check out the Instagram. There's probably a new release every week of whiskey. There's a brand new one coming out from Strong Rope Brewery tomorrow. It's called not the Seeds of Love and Outrage, but it's a very hoppy whiskey. Oh, Social Butterfly. It's Jason's double IPA.
Nice.
Yeah. Really.
Yeah.
Gorgeous.
I mean the IPA flavors. I mean I the other half coffee stout with cacao was delicious, but those were flavors I've definitely encountered in whiskey before.
Yeah.
The hop flavor.
But usually
from the IPA.
Flavored, and that's the interesting part.
Sure.
Yeah.
But the hop flavor that comes through from the KCBC IPA was just amazing in the whiskey.
We'll have to show you some more sometime.
Great. Thanks everybody for listening to Feast Your Ears. Big thank you to David Tatasciore for engineering this show every week and to Heritage Radio. You can find Feast Your Ears as well as lots of other great shows at heritageradionetwork.org. Please take a moment to like this show online on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can follow me on Instagram @TheFoodBaller. Talk to you next week.
Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content and to hear about exclusive events, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter @heritage_radio. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Rate the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join our community by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.